Here's where you can find out more about winning cases involving brain injury. Welcome to our Brain Science and the Law podcast for September 2010 on changes in personality and social behavior following traumatic brain injury. This is Dr. Valerie Stone from Answers About Brain Injury, LLC. In today's podcast, I'll cover four key points, three things you might be missing in your cases, plus some thoughts about juries' perceptions of plaintiffs. First key point, you might be missing this. Social and emotional changes after brain injury result from damage to specific structures and circuits in the brain. They are objective neurological deficits. Second key point, you might be missing this. If any of your brain-injured clients have had personality change and social-emotional impairments, you need to be sure those social and emotional impairments are assessed as objectively as are their cognitive impairments. Third key point, you might be missing this. Because social and emotional changes are objective neurological deficits, there are ways that the right brain imaging can help to make that case. Fourth key point. Personality changes could mean that your brain-injured client's behavior and conversational style is less socially acceptable than it used to be. You need to get a jury to understand and empathize with that situation. That's what I'll talk about today. Social deficits and personality changes following moderate and severe traumatic brain injury include disinhibited behavior, blurting things out, difficulties with conversational turn-taking or keeping to a topic in a conversation, inappropriate jokes, mood swings, losing one's temper, sexually inappropriate comments, difficulty reading others' emotions, difficulty tracking others' intentions, and therefore vulnerability to deception or exploitation. I want to start with a story about the case of a woman we'll call Beth in Australia who suffered what was classified as a moderate traumatic brain injury in her 20s from an auto accident. She had trouble concentrating, but most notably, her personality and social behavior were profoundly changed. Beth had previously been soft-spoken and somewhat shy. Her friends described her as having been sweet and polite, maybe even a little old-fashioned. After her initial recovery from the injury, Beth was outspoken, often made rude jokes, and made a lot of sexual comments, all social behaviors that she had never engaged in before. Beth, unfortunately, didn't have a very competent neuropsychologist to evaluate her. Her neuropsych gave her a WAIS-3 IQ test and some memory tests, but memory wasn't really Beth's problem. Beth did fine on these cognitive tests. So, first of all, the evaluating neuropsych did a poor job of choosing cognitive tests. And what are better cognitive tests is something I addressed in an earlier podcast from June 2009. But second of all, and most important, the neuropsych did not address Beth's changes in social behavior with any kind of formal assessment. Beth applied for disability benefits and was denied because of her good performance on the WAIS and the memory tests. No accounting was made of her personality change. So Beth had to go back to work. She got a job as a receptionist in an office, but she couldn't keep her job because whenever a man phoned the office and Beth answered, she propositioned him. Her inappropriate social behavior made it difficult for her to work, and she was at risk of going bankrupt, maybe losing her home, not to mention that she was vulnerable to sexual victimization. And the happy ending is that she was seen again by a better neuropsychologist, and with some advice from researchers, including myself, her new neuropsych was able to document her social impairments objectively. Now, imagine that Beth was your client and that instead of applying for government disability, she was involved in a personal injury case involving the company insuring the other driver's car. What do you suppose they would be likely to say in a case where someone did fine on cognitive testing but was engaging in inappropriate social behavior? They would probably make the argument that there's no evidence of lasting problems from brain injury and that she could change her social behavior if she wanted to. I'm here to say that's not true. As a society, we recognize that someone with a stroke affecting her motor cortex cannot help the fact that she cannot move one side of her body. We recognize that someone with Alzheimer's disease cannot help the fact that he cannot remember who came to visit this morning. But with social deficits, our society tends not to recognize that some people with neurological damage might have difficulty reading social cues, inhibiting impulses, or being aware of how their social behavior is inappropriate. The general attitude still seems to be that someone who's socially inappropriate has a personal or moral failing, I want to emphasize that that is not accurate. Neurological damage can cause impairments in social behavior. Certain parts of the brain and certain circuits in the brain are specialized for processing social and emotional information. This is hard and fast neuroscience, but awareness of these facts has not made it into popular understanding yet, and it hasn't even made it into neuropsychology yet for the most part. The field of social neuroscience has been an active and growing field for the past 15 years, but it sometimes takes a while for the newest research in neuroscience to filter down into neuropsychology and clinical psychology. Parts of the brain that allow us to be social include circuits connecting the lower part of the frontal lobes, called orbitofrontal or ventral frontal areas, the thalamus and the amygdala, a structure within the temporal lobes. So that's one set of circuits. It also involves circuits connecting the frontal lobes to other brain regions that process social information like others' faces, gestures, and voices. There are certain parts further back in the brain that are specialized for those kinds of information. Certain hormones and neurotransmitters, like oxytocin and serotonin, are heavily involved in social behavior, so neural circuits within the brain that secrete and use these chemicals are also an important part of the brain's social information processing. You may also have heard of mirror neurons in the frontal and parietal lobes of the brain, neurons that seem to be a key to empathy. All of these brain areas and circuits that are studied in the field of social neuroscience can be damaged in traumatic brain injury. I really want people to get this point. Just as a stroke survivor whose language areas are damaged cannot help the fact that she cannot speak, just as a man with Alzheimer's disease cannot help the fact that he cannot remember things, brain injury survivors whose social brain areas have been damaged cannot help the fact that they cannot perceive social information accurately or cannot behave in the socially appropriate way that they did before the damage occurred. It is crucial that you get this point across to a jury when you have a brain-injured client whose social behavior is impaired. One way to do that is to make sure that neuropsychologists who evaluate your clients use objective, quantitative measures of impairment in social behavior. Unfortunately, a lot of neuropsychologists feel much better equipped to measure someone's cognition than they feel they are to measure someone's social and emotional impairments. There is ample scientific research to show that social and emotional impairments can be independent of cognitive impairments. However, some neuropsychologists still cling to the belief that a client's social problems after traumatic brain injury can be completely explained by the client's cognitive problems. And look, I have all these nice tests to measure cognitive problems, so I'm just going to stick to the tests I know. Well, it just isn't so. Social and emotional problems can be independent of cognitive problems. So, I recommend asking the neuropsychs who assess your clients to tell you which objective tests they use to specifically assess social and emotional abilities in your client. Even if the available tests are fewer in number than the available cognitive tests, there are still many, many available social and emotional tests, and neuropsychs need to become more aware of them. I'm working on that with continuing education for psychologists. I talked about some of these tests in an earlier podcast from June 2009. Okay, first, there are questionnaire measures of personality change, and there's several different ones. All are much better than the MMPI. A good neuropsych will know that they need to get both the client's own responses about themselves on a questionnaire and also a family member or close friend's responses about the client because they can be a little different. Second, there are rating scales that clinicians use to rate inappropriate conversational behavior, and there's a couple of different options there. Third, and best, there are tests that require a client to use their social and emotional abilities to answer a question or solve a problem, almost like a social IQ test. Fourth, there are ways of measuring someone's physiological responses to emotional situations. People with more severe traumatic brain injuries often have some damping down of their bodily emotional responses. Finally, there are also social tests and assessments on which people with brain injury typically do very well, so these tests could serve as symptom validity tests. You want to make sure that neuropsychs who are assessing your clients are using some of these. Another way to get across to a jury that a brain-injured client's personality change or social behavior issues are caused by brain damage is to get good brain imaging that shows damage or dysfunction in the social areas in the brain. Go back to the May podcast on complicated mild TBI to get information on different kinds of brain imaging, but remember, CT scans are less likely to show what you need a jury to see. There are many scientific studies that show that structural MRI scans are more likely to show areas of damage that CT scans miss. MRI scans can show smaller lesions in some of these social areas of the brain. Diffusion tensor imaging has thus far only been used to show damage to white matter in TBI rather than showing specific disconnections between specific brain regions. But damaged white matter will definitely mean that some of the brain circuits that process social information are disrupted, that they're not functioning correctly. Functional imaging, either fMRI or high-density EEG, showing abnormal responses to social or emotional stimuli, that kind of EEG is called an event-related potential, could both help to make the case that a client has neurologically based social and emotional changes resulting from a brain injury. So those are some medical kinds of evidence that you can get. Now, one final point. If a client's personality has changed, if their social behavior has changed because of a brain injury, one unfortunate fact is that they're more likely to be rejected socially than they were before their injury. There's a lot of research to show that rejection and social isolation are consequences of brain injury, and I think they're some of the saddest consequences. A client with issues in social and emotional functioning may not always come across as likable to a jury. You need to get a jury to understand that the very fact that a client seems socially odd or inappropriate is a reason for empathy, not for judgment. Rehabilitation can help improve many of these social issues, so the person has to learn a new way of being in the world. You need to get a jury to understand that this person's personality is a result of parts of their brain getting damaged. You need to get a jury to see someone in the situation with compassion for their struggle, for their possible loneliness, and for their humanity as they work to become someone new with a different personality than they had before their injury. I can help you with the science, but your job is to tell the client's story with compassion. Next month's podcast will cover how medical marijuana in Colorado might lead to lawsuits against prescribing doctors and care providers, and how brain scans are being used to answer questions about criminal culpability. I've talked about some of my research and others' research in this podcast. My articles are available on my website, www.assesscompetency.com/articles.html. Information in this podcast is up to date as of September 2010. For more information about brain injury and CLE workshops that we offer, go to our website, assesscompetency.com. And thanks for listening to this month's Brain Science and the Law podcast.